comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth, thank you for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. I know you could be doing a million other things, but you've chosen to be here, and I'm delighted you have. We're here because you have a right to know, and we're here because you matter. Only 4 days left until Christmas. If you live on my side of the earth, if you live on the other side of the earth, it's 3 days until Christmas. Either way, we are rapidly approaching the Christmas holiday. Now, look, I hope you can be with family and friends during the holidays. That's just the very best thing that can happen during the holidays. But if you're traveling, most especially if you're traveling by automobile, be sure that you leave early and slow down. Don't be in such a rush to get there. So you'll get there safely, okay? Because, you know, you're important to us here at the Kevin Smith Show, and we don't want to lose anybody over the Christmas holidays. And I know you don't want to either. We publish something called the K-Files. For those who are brand new to the Kevin Smith Show, you don't know about the K-Files. Well, the K-Files is our free weekly newsletter, absolutely free. And all you have to do is subscribe to it. How do you do that? Well, you go to my website, where you really ought to be anyway, because it's free to watch. This is my Christmas gift to Earth. It's free to watch this week. And so you go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, and you'll see on the page where it says K-Files. Just click that and subscribe. Now, you're going to get an email that has a link in it. You have to use that link to activate your subscription. So do that, and you're in. Now, you can unsubscribe anytime you want to. We don't give that list to anybody. We don't rent it out, sell it, loan it, any of that kind of stuff. So you're not going to get spammed as a result of subscribing to the K-Files. So go over there and do something really genius level tonight, and that is subscribe to the K-Files. We do have a lot of new people who are joining us each and every night. And so let me say, if you're watching the show tonight at my website, I'm glad you are, and but you need to know, this is not a television show. The Kevin Smith Show is a radio show. It is not an internet radio show. It is a radio show. It is carried, however, on internet as one way of the show being distributed. It's also on AM, FM, shortwave, all mobile devices, and for those who are members here at the Kevin Smith Show, they get to watch as the radio show is done each night. And that's a pretty cool thing, because a lot of times we have lots and lots of pictures and videos and things to put up, but most of the time it's just watching the radio show. However, you never know till you tune in. So you want to be sure and join the Kevin Smith Show. It's easy to do. Just click where it says join, and you'll see all the information about how to do it. And then you will be in that inner circle, in the circle of the enlightened. All right, we're going to step away for a break. And when we come back, we will be talking with my guest, Tom Fusco. All right. right. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. This is Kevin Smith, your host. And here on the Kevin Smith Show, we talk about all the things that a lot of people consider strange and unexplained. Well, my guest this evening, Tom Fusco, has written a book called Behind the Cosmic Veil, A New Vision of Reality. And some of the topics discussed in this book certainly qualify it for our genre. Tom, welcome to the Kevin Smith Show. We're delighted to have you. Hello, Tom. Folks, this is unbelievable. I just spoke with Tom. Unbelievable. Okay. Well, we cannot hear Tom, so we shall call him back. I hate it when that happens. You know, it happens. So, there you go. Tom, I don't know what happened. You and I had just spoken, and when I tried to bring you up online, I couldn't hear you.
Well, I couldn't hear anything either. I guess that's because we were just getting to the good part.
Yeah, okay. Well, anyway, I had just said that you've written this book called Behind the Cosmic Veil, A New Vision of Reality. And some of the topics in this book, some of the things you talk about, in fact, most of it, actually really qualify it for our genre of show, and we're delighted to have you. Welcome. We're glad you're here, even though we had to get you back online, and I apologize for that. Don't know what happened, but we're glad you're here. Welcome.
Thank you, and I'm glad to be here as well.
Okay, Tom, we're going to talk about this book, and we're going to get into some detail, really, about what this book is all about. But before we do that, I want people to get to know you. Just a little bit. Tell us a little bit about your background. Who is Tom?
Well, I'm an independent researcher, and I have a diverse background in a lot of different fields. Most of that has been the result of my study and research for this book, which actually began as a very young age. I had experienced in my teen years a few experiences that people would call psychic phenomena. And for me, those kinds of events and those kinds of experiences did not fit into the worldview that I was taught scientifically, logically, socially. And so I knew that the model of the universe that we had was somehow flawed and incorrect. And so I spent many years researching it until I came upon what I believe is the solution.
Okay. Now, you are an author. You've got this book published, and it contains some heavyweight material. But you are, and I think this is kind of important, you're involved in the computer industry, correct?
Yes. Computer technology is what I do for a living.
Now, the reason I say that is important is because I think people need to understand that even though this book tackles some pretty esoteric concepts, takes on, kind of head on some of these esoteric concepts. You're somebody that is, you're really firmly anchored in, I think what anybody would say if you're dealing with computers and computer technology, you're pretty firmly anchored in science, logic, and, not given to flights of fancy. And I think that's important. You experienced some events in your life, as you described, that you thought, we would describe them as psychic. And I'm just curious now that you've written this book, do you still define them as psychic?
Well, I'm not crazy about the word psychic. because I just think that it carries a bit too much baggage with it. And also, it infers something very specialized and very unusual and very isolated from normal human experience and normal physical processes. But, of course, in my book, I describe a universe that's quite a bit larger, where these types of things are a natural part of its functions. And so psychic is something that implies that it's outside of those processes, and I've come to understand that it really isn't.
Well, you know, that fits pretty well with something I say frequently, and that is that the classic definition of things, of the word paranormal, would be things for which we have no scientific explanation yet. So if we don't have a scientific explanation for it, it gets classified as paranormal. Well, with that being the case, almost the entire universe under that definition, almost the entire universe would be paranormal, because we don't understand most of what's out there. I have also said that we just don't understand it yet. And once we do, we won't call these things paranormal. Once we understand them, we won't say they're paranormal or supernatural. And an example of that, Tom, let me see what you think about this. I think an example of that would be if you could take a jet airplane and go back in time 200 years, I think the people that see 200 years ago, the people that would see this jet aircraft flying through the air might think it's something supernatural. And just 200 years ago. But to us, it's not. And someday, a lot of the things we call supernatural or paranormal, today we call them that. Someday, people will not be calling them that. It'll just be normal and natural, and they'll understand how it works. And I think that's kind of what your book does, right? It kind of shows how these things work.
Yes, Kevin, it's very much, a part of it is very much along those lines. We haven't advanced far enough, I think, for us to completely lose that term paranormal, because we don't understand those things well enough to come up with some really good alternatives to that. Mm-hmm. However, is to the extent that I felt I could go with that, was to try to give what is paranormal, quote-unquote, rather than being a catch-all basket for anything that we don't understand. Mm-hmm. I tried to give it a scientific explanation. And for me, what is paranormal is any physical effect that is observable and it interacts with its environment, so it's physical, but has no direct physical cause that we can detect. And so that falls under the scientific explanation of non-local causality, or non-locality for short. And so for me then, things like we would see in haunted houses, disembodied voices, apparitions, those types of things, certainly fall under the idea of non-locality, that we're seeing physical effects, mm-hmm. like hearing a disembodied voice, but no direct physical cause connected to it, like a set of vocal cords.
Okay, now before...
What this does for us, too, it allows us to take that concept of paranormal and bring it into the normal realm. For example, when we look at certain aspects of quantum physics, we find the same type of non-locality. So rather than being caught in a rut of trying to explain the paranormal in terms of quantum physics, my approach is to demonstrate that certain aspects of quantum physics are themselves paranormal. And in that way, I feel that I'm taking those first steps to break those traditional conceptual bonds that you were talking about, mm-hmm. and try to usher us into a new way of looking at things.
All right, before we get too deeply into this, Let me ask you, because your book is entitled Behind the Cosmic Veil, A New Vision of Reality. So we can assume that you think we need a new vision of reality. Let's talk about that for a moment. Why do we need a new vision of reality?
Well, we have a couple reasons for that. The first is the observable phenomena that we see that does not fit in the current standard scientific model of the universe. And I feel that the collection of data that we call paranormal phenomena, specifically like the kinds of events that people experience in the sites of what they would call a haunting, are genuine observations that don't fit in that model. The other aspect that is the evidence that we need a new model is that physics, by its nature, seeks a materialistic explanation for everything. Every material effect must have a material cause behind it. But in recent decades, Kevin, we've come up with a number of new observations that has left physics in a place where they have simply run out of material. Very plain and simply, we have simply run out of material to explain all of the observations that we have now. And we've been trying to find some of that material. For example, the imaginary and hypothetical dark matter is one such fabrication in the attempt to devise material, extra material, to explain what we can't, we don't have real material for, to explain what we observe. So those two aspects are examples of why we do need a new model of reality.
All right. So then your approach would be that forget the dark matter, because that's not, and actually has not been firmly proven to exist anyway. There's something else at work, and you're going after what is the something else at work, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Dark matter is important to the extent that it allows us to think about why physics has dreamed this imaginary substance of. And the reason why is because we've come to discover that close to 90% of the gravity in the universe has no adjacent local causal mass. We have, basically, if we look at the gravitational effects in the universe, our material content of the universe is short by almost 90%. And so here we have an example of a gravitational effect that, according to our earlier definition, is paranormal. Mm-hmm. We actually have an observable physical effect that affects its physical surroundings, but there is no detectable direct physical cause.
Well, and yeah, by the sort of primitive definition that I use for paranormal, yeah, it would be, that's one of the things I'm talking about. It would be paranormal because we cannot explain it scientifically. And
and because we don't yet have a better word to replace that with, I feel that we're good at this time in history with working with that paranormal term for now.
No, fair enough. Fair enough. All right, now you, in your book, talk about supergeometry. And on my Facebook page, I put on there that you were going to be on the show and that we would talk about supergeometry and supernatural mechanics and other things. And someone posted a comment and kind of questioned, you know, did I mean sacred geometry? And my comment back was, well, the word you use is super geometry, so I guess we'll find out together. And so let's do that. What are we talking about with super geometry?
Well, super geometry is is a terminology used to describe the collection of information that we were mentioning earlier about the makeup of the universe. Everything in the universe comprises information. And so in phenomena like the paranormal, and in phenomena like certain aspects of quantum physics, like photon teleport and quantum entanglement, and certain aspects of gravity itself, we see that they are comprised of information, but the source of information isn't stored in physical space and time. Therefore, that information exists outside of space-time. Now, that concept, Kevin, in itself is not new. That concept has gone by many names over the centuries. As far back as the Bible and before, the Bible would call this the wisdom of God or the Word of God. It's been called universal intelligence, cosmic consciousness, the mind of God. In the 20th century, physicist David Bohm called it implicate order. That gave rise to explicate order, which is what our physical realm of space and time is. It's also been called configuration space. What I wanted to do with the word supergeometry is to not only give it an identity that gives it some sort of a tangibility, rather than just saying that this is some ambiguous form of information. It actually is a form of super geometry, a structure, a matrix, which is outside of space-time that could be understood in terms of geometry. And so that gives us something a little bit more tangible to go on than the more ambiguous collection of information. As far as sacred geometry, I've heard that term before, but I try real hard to stay away from a religious expression here if I can.
Okay, so what are we talking about with super geometry, though? I mean, when we talk about geometry, you know, certain famous names like Pythagoras come to our minds, and these names come to our minds because these are people who worked out and put down in words theorems. Do we have such things beginning to happen now with this super geometry?
Well, in a sense, yes.
Okay, we have to step away for a break. It just took over. Folks, we will be back, and we'll ask Tom about super geometry when we get back. Don't go away.
To the Kevin Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We're talking this evening with Tom Fosco. And Tom, are you still with us?
Yes, sir.
All right. We made it through that break and didn't lose Tom. That's a good thing. Okay, so I had asked the question, I had couched it this way, that with geometry as we know it, certain names come to mind. I mentioned Pythagoras, and because they have worked out and put down into words and formulas that we can understand certain geometric theorems that we learn and that we know. So what about this super geometry that you're talking about? Is anybody working with it like that now?
In the basic concept, yes. There is certain theoretical work being done exploring the types of superphysical or extra-dimensional elements that I call super geometry. And the difficulty with these things, Kevin, is that all of our measuring instruments, including our flesh and blood ones, our brains, our eyes, our ears, the instruments that we use to form physical models are all confined by the four common dimensions of our physical universe, the three spatial dimensions and the one temporal dimension. So when we get beyond that and we talk about something that's extra-dimensional or super-dimensional, it's very difficult for us to derive good conceptual models. But I think a good way to convey what you're asking about is to give an example of a supergeometric structure that I think most people would understand.
All right.
If we take a Euclidean line, which is a joining of two points, that is considered a one-dimensional object. If we take that line and we square it to itself, we get a two-dimensional object that's called a square. If we take that square and we square it to itself, we have a cube, which is a three-dimensional object in space that has length, width, and height. Now, what if we take that cube and square it to itself? We get a super geometric construct, which mathematicians call a tesseract. It is a it's a geometric object that's projected in the four physical dimensions. Now, from our perspective, that's a physical impossibility. But conceptually and mathematically, it represents a superstructure or a supergeometric structure that, although we cannot represent it physically, we can understand that within that supergeometric structure is all the information and all the definitions from which can be derived the cube, the square, and the line. So we might say that those dimensional elements that we can see and measure in our dimensional space-time emerge from, or we could even say trickle down from, this supergeometric structure that contains all the information for those three-dimensional geometric figures.
That is fascinating, and I'll tell you, I don't remember if I was coming home from a conference somewhere or if it was when I was coming back from shooting a television show pilot, but I was traveling, and I was on the airplane next to a man from India. He was a PhD, and he was headed somewhere, I think he was headed to Dallas. I'm not sure. Anyway, he was going to a conference for mathematicians. And I said, well, you know, that's kind of interesting. I didn't know mathematicians had conferences. What kind of math are you, what sort of math are you into? And he told me something that sort of baffled me. He said, you wouldn't understand it. I said, well, I'm sure I wouldn't, but give me a shot here. He said, I'm into mathematics. All of us at this convention are into mathematics, for which there is no known application. And I wonder, now that you're talking about supergeometry, if that's what he was into.
Well, Kevin, it kind of makes sense. I think that what he was talking about is mathematics based on what they call abstract or imaginary numbers rather than real numbers. The wonderful thing about the work that I've done, though, is that it draws a conceptual model of how these superphysical mathematical constructs can actually materialize in the physical reality. We've known that these things exist. We've seen evidence that this superstructure exists to reality. We've speculated and surmised how this material or this information must somehow dictate the nature of our physical reality, and yet we have not yet come upon a model that shows us how this information could actually materialize. And so that's really a big thrust of my book, is what the mechanism is behind that.
Well, if taking your example of, what did you call it, a tesseract?
Yes, that's what it's called.
Okay, taking your example that it contains all the information from which we derive the cube, the square, and the line, and realizing that we see and experience cubes, squares, and lines, but we do not see and experience tesseracts. It's kind of like that deal with, a blind man trying to describe an elephant.
Yes.
So he can describe what he can touch, but that's it. And so what we're touching of the universe is basically a bump on the butt of a bull.
Yes, in a sense. What we see, as you say, all that we can see is the effect. We cannot see the primary cause to reality. But we, from the effects that we can observe, we can come to an understanding that there is a cause to these effects that exists outside of space-time. For example, in quantum physics, we have a phenomena that's called quantum entanglement. And to make a long story short, if we have two particles that are entangled in such a way so that each has an opposite polarity, and they're correlated, they're tied together, so the two opposite polarities balance, and those particles are split apart, so they fly away from each other at the speed of light. And the particle A, for example, is passed through a polarizing filter that reverses its polarity. Particle B will instantaneously reverse its own polarity in response in order to maintain the balance in the correlated pair. The problem is, Kevin, that they're traveling away from each other at the speed of light, which means, and this phenomenon occurs whether they're the particles are separated by 5 inches or 500,000 light years. And so what we're looking at is the information about particle A is being transferred to particle B at what we would call infinite velocity. It's not even a velocity on the scale of light speed or faster than light speed. It's infinity. It means that the information about particle A exists in every quadrant of the universe at the exact same microsecond in time. Now, since we know that's physically impossible, that is very strong evidence for this super geometric structure that overlays physical reality that we can't see because it exists above the speed of light.
Well, we could push that a little further, too, and say that if particle A exists absolutely everywhere there is in the universe at the same time, then really there only is particle A.
Yes, but we know that from in dimensional space-time, we know that can't be. Mm-hmm. But what we know that can be is that the information regarding the nature and state of particle A, not the particle itself, but the information that defines its nature and describes its characteristics, can be transmitted to every section of the universe at the exact same moment. And since we have no carrier, no physical carrier like a light beam that could travel that fast, we understand that information is being distributed across the universe from a source that lies outside and above it.
Well, if we ever get where we really understand that, and we can use quantum physics for our space travel instead of using our physics as we know it today, our Einsteinian physics, we switch and start using quantum physics for space travel, it would seem to me that we could be anywhere in the universe in an instant.
You've got it, Kevin. The beauty about the way that I go about it is rather than to try to understand technologically how we would fabricate such a system, my model works under the assumption that the system already exists within creation itself, and that all we need to do is learn how to tap into it and exploit it.
Well, I tell you what, you know, here on this show I have little sayings, things, not just on the show, but me as a person. I have these little sayings that I say sometimes. I call them Kevinisms.
There you go.
Now, one of them you just described, and that is everything that ever will be possible has always been possible. It's just waiting on right thinking. And
yes, in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Our trick there to that, which has been one of the confines that we've been held back by, is the conceptual models that allows us to understand what, quote-unquote, everything is.
Oh, well, so, see, that gets into not having right thinking. Once we get our thinking right, everything that ever will be possible has always been possible. It's possible right now if we were doing right thinking. All right, we have to step away for a break. And when we come back, I want to get beyond super geometry into supernatural mechanics. We've heard of quantum mechanics, haven't we? Well, Tom talks about supernatural mechanics. And maybe he can explain to us, and I know he will, what that's all about. All right, we're going to step away. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest is Tom Fosco, and Tom, I had asked about supernatural mechanics when we stepped away. Let's talk about that. What are we talking about? Your book mentions supernatural mechanics. What is that?
Well, the best way to describe that is to relate it to the body of evidence that we call paranormal phenomena, more specifically that end of it where we talk about the observations that are made in sites of hauntings, ghosts, that type of thing. And to try to crack the secret behind what is going on here, to try to get some kind of a conceptualization, I spend a lot of time thinking about the universe at large and coming up with something in that could give me a hint as to what's going on. And what happened, Kevin, I kept coming back to gravity. And that seems mysterious at first until we understand that we really don't know what gravity is. We know what gravity does. Every time we talk about gravity, what you learn in school, what astrophysicists use to calculate the orbits of planets and the structure of galaxies and even the trajectories of spacecraft, is all dealing with gravitational effect. But as far as the substance of gravity itself, we still don't know. If we're going to give it a material explanation, we need to discover three different hypothetical particles. We need to discover the graviton. We've been searching for decades for it. We cannot find it. We need to discover dark matter. We can't find that either. And we also need to discover the Higgs boson, which we're not being able to find that either. In fact, the physicists working at the Large Hadron Collider over in CERN, over in Europe, have begun to lose hope that they're going to find the Higgs boson, because it has not been found in the places where it was supposed to be, and they've looked already. So now they're looking for places where it might be, but it really shouldn't, according to the theory.
Okay, so, well, let me postulate something then. If we have not found the graviton, that doesn't mean we won't, but let's say we don't. Let's say we never discover it. If we have not found the Higgs boson, which we haven't, that doesn't mean that we won't, but let's say that we don't. We never find it. That means that there is every possibility that these are fiction and they do not exist, and that they were introduced as fudge factors to make standard physics work.
Correct.
Okay, so if they don't exist, and yet we have gravity, and we have gravity occurring in places and in amounts, in magnitude, for which there is no observable cause, then where would you say that is coming from? What is producing it? If we have an effect, we have to have a producer. We have to have a cause somewhere. So if it's not in the physics that we observe, then where would be the cause?
Well, that's a good question. And the challenge I think that we have with this is we need, it's not a question that we can answer until we've answered some other questions. And so what I'd like to do is kind of address what I feel are the important questions that lead us up to that particular answer. And like you said, although we can't exclude the fact that we'll never find a graviton, back in the 19th century, there was an imaginary substance that was theorized back then, too, called the ether. And the physical problem that the ether was attempting to solve was that, according to Isaac Newton, space was empty. It was a nothingness. And so in the ensuing studies with particles and forces like electricity, it was discovered that electrical fields would sustain themselves and suspend themselves in empty space. And according to Newtonian physics, this didn't make sense. You would have to have a physical substance in order to create waves. So what it was like, if I could make an example, it was like throwing a stone into an empty pond with no water in it. There was no way that it could make waves, and yet they saw waves in this empty pond. So they made up this imaginary substance called the ether, which would propagate the waves and explain what they saw in electrical fields and still maintain Newtonian space. Now, what Einstein did was he just accepted the experimental results at the time and said there just simply isn't any ether. The challenge that he met was to come up with a model of reality which was more accurate than the one that was made with ether, and by the very power of that model, dismissed forever the idea that ether existed. So our challenge with dark matter is the same type of a quandary. We need to come up with a model that is more accurate at describing the universe than the model that incorporates imaginary dark matter. And so for me, gravity is definitely the key, because any attempt at creating a mathematical equation for Einstein's unified field stumbles on gravity. Every attempt to make relativity and quantum mechanics reconcile with one another stops at gravity. This is the stumbling block. Every time we try to complete our standard model of the universe, we stumble upon gravity. So what do we have with gravity? We have bent space. We have twisted and warped space, always in association with gravitational fields. And so what I look at, or what I did look at, is say, okay, let's say that this is a fundamental paranormal effect. Let's take this bending of space and bring it inside of a haunted house and see what we would find. So the first thing that we would find, if we had an expanding bubble of space-time in a haunted house, is that the twisting and the compressing of space that it would cause on its outer edge, and the compression of the air molecules that would be there, would create an electromagnetic field. And so when investigators go into those houses with electric magnetic meters, they detect rises in electromagnetic fields prior to paranormal manifestations. Another thing that it would create, it would agitate and excite the molecules in the air that are on that outer edge of that expanding bubble. It's compressing space and crushing and contorting the air molecules. So what that would do is excite the electrons and cause them to leap into higher orbits. And when that excitation is expended and those electrons drop back down, we would have two different effects based on the conditions. One would be that those electrons would release heat. And when they take thermal imaging devices in these haunted sites, they indeed see thermal images. Another thing that it would create, and this is very well known, one of the things that electrons do when they drop down into their lower valences is they emit photons. It's not perfectly understood how that does, but we know that it does. So here in our everyday life, we have an example of an electromagnetic field that is exciting the electrons in a particular material, that when they drop back down, they emit photons, and that's what we call an LED. It's a light-emitting diode. So what I just described is what the paranormal researchers call an orb. Now, that's half of it. Let's take a look at the inside of the bubble. We've talked about the outside. Let's talk about the inside. So if we have an expanding bubble of space-time, imagine if we were able to visualize the bending of space around an object like the sun. And let's say that we plucked that sun outside of space-time, just took it right out of that location, and we had this bubble of space-time around it with no material inside of it, just like we see in great expanses of space where they detect gravitational lensing with no matter. Well, what that would do, Kevin, it would effectively produce a vacuum. It would not only be a material vacuum, but it would also be a thermal vacuum.
All right, we have to step away for break. We'll be back, ladies and gentlemen, right after this, so don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Tom Fosco. And, Tom, you were talking about this expanding bubble of space-time, and we had to step away for break. So let me allow you to continue with that.
Yes, I think I had talked about what would happen on the outside edge of this expanding bubble. And what I was talking about is the inside then of the expanding bubble. If we could imagine this bubble expanding very slowly, there would not be much of a vacuum inside of it, because there would be plenty of time for the ambient material of the air molecules and the thermal energy in the area to kind of slip and seep into that vacuum like water seeking its own level. But if it expanded fast enough so that that couldn't happen gracefully, so to speak, what we would have is a temporary material and a thermal vacuum. So in that area where that bubble would be expanding, one of the things that we would detect would be a cold spot. And that's exactly what paranormal investigators detect. It would be like opening the door, the front door, on a very cold, blustery day. The other thing that this would cause in this vacuum, it would suck air inside of it very quickly. And so what what we would find is that we would feel a breeze with all the windows and doors closed, which is again observed quite a few times at the site of paranormal activity. Another important aspect to this, Kevin, is that what many paranormal investigators report in the vicinity of paranormal activity is that they talk about a feeling of heaviness. And 99 out of 100 people use the same word. It's not like something where 10 different people give 8 different expressions of it. Everybody uses the same word. So it must be very distinct, and the feeling must be very familiar, because we all know what heavy means. Well, what would the bending of space-time create? It creates gravitational fields. So the feeling of heaviness that the witnesses in that vicinity are feeling are literally true. So when we take this particular part of my model, we find that it explains every single secondary paranormal effect with the exact same model in a consistent and convincing and scientific way.
Okay, so are you saying then that these paranormal, observable paranormal phenomena would not be ghosts?
Well, not exactly. Because when we're talking about ghosts, we're talking about a spirit-centric cause. And this is one of the problems that we've had in the paranormal field, where all the observations are associated mentally with the idea of a ghost or a spirit. And when you set that apart and separate it from the phenomena itself, then you're able to see what's going on. A good example is what paranormal investigators suspect when their batteries and their devices malfunction. They'll say, well, a spirit is draining energy in order to physically manifest. And they come up with that explanation because they're thinking about a ghost. But in ufology, the exact same phenomena occurs. In the vicinity of UFOs, people's electrical devices go dead, batteries go dead. Those types of observations are identical, and yet no one would say that the UFO is draining your Everettys out of your flashlight in order to physically manifest. That's because the UFO observer is not thinking about a ghost. And so, to answer your question, though, to get specifically about a ghost, what is a ghost? A ghost is a collection of information that is materializing. And so according to my model, if we have a collection of information that defines a human being that may have been deceased, and that information is injected into that expanding bubble, then it will materialize and we will witness what we call a ghost.
Okay, so what you're talking about then really doesn't address whether it's a ghost or not, but addresses sort of the physical mechanics of what's going on around this phenomena.
Yes, Kevin, and the way I look at it is this. When a police force investigates a crime scene, let's say someone was murdered with a gun, they have a couple of different teams. One of the teams is the criminologist. They're concerned about who done it. They want to know all about the perpetrator. Then there's the forensics examiner. He wants to know all about the physical nature of the crime itself. Unfortunately, in the paranormal field and even in ufology, we have 100 criminologists for every 0.5 forensics examiners. And so, for me, I want to separate that spiritual aspect of it out and let the criminologists worry about whether the rattling pans have to do with dead Aunt Mary getting your attention, or a demon trying to torment the family, or an adolescent girl that is causing a poltergeist phenomena. And I just want to know why the pots and pans are rattling.
Okay. Fair enough. Fair enough. So your model, your new vision of reality, doesn't dismiss the possibility of ghosts then?
Absolutely not, Kevin. In fact, what the theory puts forth is that we have coherent collections of information that can manifest physically. We ourselves are coherent collections of information that are intelligent. Our human brains are part of the physical universe, and therefore must be constructed according to universal laws. If the universe created intelligence, then collections of information within it must be intelligent. So there's every reason to believe that this superphysical construct contains assemblies of information that are indeed intelligent, just like we are.
Well, which came first, the chicken or the egg here? Did the universe create intelligence, or did intelligence create the universe?
Exactly. And, of course, that's the debate between the atheists and the believers of God.
Well, it is, but even it's even a debate amongst atheists, just atheists, because there are certain atheist theories that do not posit the existence of God, but do posit some sort of impersonal intelligence that's at work out there. Not a personal God, but some sort of cosmic impersonal intelligence. A consciousness that's out there. And so even among atheists, that's a huge debate.
Yes, Einstein himself was a theist, and that's what he postulated. He said that because there were laws, there had to be a lawgiver. And so he believed that too, but he did not believe in like a Jewish God or a Christian God. And he used to argue very much against what he called the radical atheists. He thought their position was completely unjustified and reactionary.
Well, personally, so do I. And I'm not a religious person. But I do find that my personal opinion is that the really card carrying, if you will, card carrying atheists, wear it on their sleeve kind of guys, I think they are reactionary and kind of closed minded on some things that prevent us from making progress. But, see, one of the problems is explaining how consciousness works, because it has been scientifically demonstrated and measured that a plant knows your thoughts. It will react to your thoughts, not just your words and not just playing music, but your thoughts. It'll react to your thoughts. And that doesn't mean, I've said it this way, it doesn't mean a plant has consciousness. It means that a plant is consciousness, just as we are a piece of consciousness as well. And we're sort of all a piece of the same stuff. And so it doesn't have to have brain cells. It doesn't have to be able to think in order for consciousness to be working in it.
Mm-hmm. our challenge has always been, Kevin, to try to find a cosmological framework in which that factoid fits comfortably.
Yeah, well, it doesn't in any that I know.
Well, my conceptual model is this, and it's based on sound scientific reasoning, that every system that exists has a set of laws and principles which establishes the nature and the behavior and the construction of that system. That's a scientific fact. That means that every component within that system must operate according to the principles that govern the greater system. A component of that system cannot act contrary to or outside of those principles that govern the greater system in which it is a component. Consequently, since we are intelligent and we are a component of the universe, which they say, science says, that our brain is a result of cosmological processes, then that means if we're intelligent, then the system that gave rise to us is intelligent also. And I think I've got a few atheists that I've debated that will probably chew on that bone for the next 20 years.
Well, we cannot be other than the origin, whatever the origin is. We are, as you say, components, constituent parts of whatever that origin is. But based on the supergeometry concept and the supernatural mechanics concept, I'm still left with intelligence of some type existing outside the cosmos and injecting, projecting the cosmos, producing the cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
Would that fit, or am I misreading that?
No, because, again, if we go back to the fundamental question of where intelligence came from, if we're forced to the conclusion that the universe itself is intelligent, then we would have to ask the question where that intelligence came from. And so we find everywhere in the early universe, when we study it to the extent that we can, we find that the cosmic cloud, the primordial soup that was the result of the Big Bang, everywhere in the universe began to coalesce in the type of molecular and atomic structures that we see everywhere in the universe happening at the same time. There was no trial and error evolutionary process where materials assembled and disassembled in order to come up with the first atom, and then every other atom was propagated from that. Every part of the cosmic soup began to coalesce according to a set of laws that must have already existed. And so those set of laws have an order, and they came from somewhere.
Okay. Does your theory propose where those set of laws came from?
Yes, from the supergeometric superstructure that is clearly intelligent. If I go beyond that, Kevin, I fall into religion. And one of the things that I did that helped me find what other people have not was that I didn't cross that line. That I stopped and said, okay, it's like the criminologist asks me, is it possible that God created or committed this crime called the universe? Criminologists ask me that question. And as the forensics examiner, I give them the structure of the crime scene and say, yes, criminologist, according to the model that I've discovered in this crime scene, that is entirely possible.
Well, the reason for my silence is I was debating whether to comment or not, simply because it's Christmas time, and I don't want to get hate mail.
I can tell everybody, your audience, that I am a believing Christian. That's what I am by faith. But in order to do the community justice, I cannot give a philosophical or a religious foundation for my theory. It's where we have all failed, because everybody's impression is slightly different. And we don't need a million different models of the universe. We only need one.
All right, so let's assume that tomorrow all of the big names in science get together and they pass your book around, they all read your book. And at the end of the day, because they're speed readers and they're really, really smart people, they pick up on it really quick. At the end of the day, they meet again and they say, they have a vote and they say, yep, this is the correct model for the universe. All right. Now, if that were to happen, of course it's not going to, but if it were, where would that leave us? How would we be better by having this one model of the universe?
Well, what it does, Kevin, is this. It gives us a foundation to understand that because we are creative beings, and you have to follow me here for a minute, that we're able to take invisible information and transform it into its visible equivalent in dimensional space. And that intelligent creativity is built into the universe by its very design, by its very structure. That would mean that not only would we understand at that point that anything that the human mind can conceive can be an actual physical reality, but at the same time it would give us a mechanism by which we could begin to build technology to make that possible. Forbidden Planet. Do you remember the science fiction movie Forbidden Planet?
Sure, yeah.
My book defines the technology or the conceptual principles by which technology like that might be built, where you put something on your head and whatever you envision in your mind physically materializes.
Well, I think, science at this point has pretty much proven that our conscious thought does have measurable, scientifically measurable impact on matter. That, of course, would give rise to the idea that you could build something that would amplify your conscious thought and really have a big impact on matter. Okay, but we could do that with the model of the universe we have now. How would this open the door to that being more of a possibility?
Well, the model of the universe that we have now does not give us the capabilities, that Jesus apparently had when he was able to feed 5,000 people with a pair of loaves and fishes.
Okay, so you're saying that if we had this model of the universe, then, see, I'm backing you into a corner here. I don't want to broadside you. I'm not trying to back you into a corner. I just recognize that it may do that. That's why I'm announcing it. All right, so what you're saying then, if we had your model of the universe in place and science says that's it, that's the model of the universe, we have a Foscoian universe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So,
I like that.
You like that? Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So then we could build the technologies that would actually give us godlike powers.
Exactly. Think about it for a second, Kevin. And all I've done in a lot of this is just take a look at things in a different way than they've been traditionally looked at, which, of course, is what people like Einstein did in their time. Take a look at something like the microphone that you're talking on, or the telephone that I'm holding, or one of the examples I use. I talk about a 57 Chevy. There is no natural process in the universe that would ever give rise and self-assemble a 57 Chevy. It's just not going to happen. Even given infinite time, one person said, and of course that's a oxymoron. Infinite time is like saying honest politician. It's funny that people think they know about infinity and talk about time on the same breath. You know, this is something that just simply is without the realm of possibility. There's no natural process that would ever assemble a 57 Chevy somewhere on the moon or Mars or wherever.
Yeah.
So that means that by definition, a 57 Chevy is not a natural construct,
right. But
it is a supernatural construct. And so consequently, we have to look at the cause that constructed it as supernatural also.
Well, I always thought that a 57 Chevy was such a fine automobile, and I still do, that only God could have created it anyway.
Well, if we venture into the Judeo-Christian model, where it says that man was made in the Creator's image, when we look at ourselves and understand that we truly are creators, that makes a whole lot of sense.
It does indeed. Now, this is getting deep, and this is getting exciting. We have to step away for a break. And when we come back from this break, we will continue talking with Tom Fosco about technologies that produce godlike results. We'll be back.
Kevin Smith Show.
All right, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and my guest Tom Fosco. But before we bring him back online, let me say, you know, we have stepped off into something here that is deep, and I think extremely fascinating, and it certainly goes right along with both what I have said in two seminars, in God's in the Garden and in the seminar Angels, Nephilim, and Anunnaki. And you did not even know I did those seminars and don't know the content of those seminars, right, Tom?
That is correct.
Okay. All right, so when we stepped away, I said, if we had your model of the universe, what you're saying is it would enable the development of technologies that basically would give us godlike powers.
Absolutely.
Do you think that's a good thing?
And what you were saying earlier about the evidence that the human consciousness can affect the physical environment around it directly.
Yeah.
Is very significant. Now, we see the evidence of that everywhere around us in the modern world. But our typical understanding of how we create is that mental imaging that we use, from which we model our reality around us with, is normally worked through our hands. It is a mechanical way of representing those images that are in our minds. However, we can extrapolate the principle a little bit further and understand that we could probably directly affect reality with those same images in our minds. All we need is a model by which we can do that. And a very important aspect of that model is coming to the understanding, and this is really the key that kind of rips the lid off the box, is that when we look at gravity and the curvatures of space, what the evidence is actually telling us, if we can get the traditional dogma out of our heads, is that it is not mass and matter which is bending the curvatures of space and creating gravity. It is actually the curvatures of matter or of space, the depressions in space, which act like nurseries or wombs in which matter materializes.
Well, you know, that makes sense because, okay, they talk about the Earth, and they always show this model where you put the Earth and it's a big ball and it's heavy and you lay it on this fabric of time, space, and it causes this depression in the fabric. And but, you know, the Earth has no weight whatsoever in space.
This is why they're desperate to find a Higgs boson. Because if they can't find the explanation for mass, then they can't put the material explanation for gravity in place. And my argument is that the reason why they've never been able to assemble a material cause for gravity is that the model is exactly opposite, Kevin. It's the curvatures of space which are the causality for matter.
Okay, and so any idea what causes the curvatures of space?
Well, we can understand that it happens from an external cause. Give you an example. The problem that Einstein had in coming up with a mathematical representation for his unified field theory, which a lot of his relativistic theories were derived from that mental concept, was that he couldn't express gravity in four dimensions mathematically, in the three spatial and one temporal. And we haven't been able till this day. But a fellow mathematician and physicist came along called Theodore Kaluza, and he worked on Einstein's equations also. But he came up with a novel idea one day. He said, let's put in a hypothetical coordinate that exists outside of space-time, and let's make that the causality of gravity. And suddenly he was able to balance Einstein's equations. He went into that super physical, like Tesseract-type mathematics, worked the equations, subtracted the superphysical element out so that we were just left with our observable four-dimension space-time, and boom, the equations balanced.
So why hasn't this gotten a lot of airplay?
Because it's a non-materialistic explanation for the universe, and the class and physics today is under control of the quantists. The relativists lost control of physics sometime in the 50s and the early 60s.
All right. But, I mean, so you know, I'm sort of I'm a pragmatist. And so if it works, why not just do it? I mean, if it works. Look, I had a very, 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 very famous physicist on this show. And I said to him, he kept talking about the laws of physics. And I said, after a little bit, I said, isn't it true that there are no laws of physics? What you're calling laws of physics are just our descriptions of our current understanding. And that's subject to change. And there was a little pause, and then he said, absolutely, that is what it is. Okay, so if they can admit that these so-called laws of physics, those are just descriptions of our current understanding. Uh-huh. Whatever real laws of physics there are beyond those descriptions. And so these are just descriptions of our current understanding. And if they can admit, as he did on this show, that that's absolutely true, why would it be so hard for them to back up and say that I think you said his name is Caluso.
Caluso.
Why can't they just back up and say, okay, for whatever reason, it works, so Caluso's right?
Uh-huh.
Why can't they do that?
Well, my feeling is this, and it is very philosophical. At the heart of quantum physics is an argument which was diametrically opposed to Einstein. Einstein said, and most people aren't familiar with this, is that he said that the final test of any physical theory is human experience. That he called physical theory a representation of reality, but it wasn't an exact description of reality. Human experience was the measure of reality. The quantum physicist took an opposite view and said, no, the physical laws are the universe themselves. The physical theory is the universe itself. And that is a very atheistic view. And we also see the same tendency in our society, that we have removed God as a ruling authority, and we have substituted it with law. And so that's exactly what our scientists have done. So to accept Caluso's fifth superphysical coordinate as a accurate model of the universe brings us into the realm of God, and they want to find the Higgs boson first to eliminate God.
Well, yeah, but see, I would say it does not necessarily postulate that there is God, because this hypothetical coordinate is hypothetical to us, and it exists in a place where we cannot go and experience, at least not yet, not now. That doesn't mean that it's not physical.
Well, according to my argument, it certainly has physical consequences. But again, the governing philosophy behind physics today is materialism.
Yeah, basically, and bank so accounts.
It excludes anything that's outside materialism, that's not material.
Well, the material that I think probably rules science, all science, more than any other material, is in the bank. I think it's the bank accounts.
Well, there's absolutely that aspect to it too, and people don't realize that when scientists are conducting these types of experiments and setting up labs, they don't stop and think, where does the money come from? The money comes from people who are looking for practical, real-world, hard solutions to things. And so they're not liable to give the money to someone who's proposing a theoretical, superphysical fifth coordinate that cannot be measured, cannot be put in a test tube, you can't make a light bulb or a car out of it, so on and so forth.
Well, they accept dark matter.
Yes, they do, surprisingly. But like I said, like I said in the book, hypothetical constructs like that can certainly be accepted in scientific circles as long as it's pronounced by one of their own prophets.
Yeah, well, that's important. And the way they get their PhDs is basically by agreeing with the PhDs who taught them. And that's how they got their PhDs. You don't normally get a PhD by coming in and saying, you know, professor, you're a nut. They get them by regurgitating what has been regurgitated now for centuries.
Uh-huh.
And with very slight modification. And that's why we move so slowly. All right, now, another thing about this is, with your model of the universe, it explains what we call free energy. And free, the two words are mutually exclusive here on Earth. Free and energy. They are mutually exclusive. If you can't put a meter on it and sell it to people, the big boys don't want to develop it. But what you're talking about and your model of the universe would have to produce enormous, immense amounts of energy, which could be tapped.
Indeed. I mean, let's put it this way, Kevin. Let's take a look again. Let's go back into the haunted house. And the free energy you're talking about is picked up on EMF meters everywhere. Mm-hmm. They pick up electromagnetic fields with no physical cause or source.
What if, and you know, we hear this all the time. We hear that the Earth itself is a gigantic battery. It has a positive pole and a negative pole. It has a magnetic field, and it's spinning. It's generating an electric field.
Mm-hmm.
So if we switch to your model of the universe, they would have to admit that not only is there an electrical field, but if I understand your model, that's a field that it's a permeating field. It's not just out there in space around us. It permeates matter.
In a sense, we have to be careful about one of the conventional thinkings, Kevin, that have gotten us into trouble in the past and has made this model, so to speak, invisible to our imagination. And that is, we have to be very careful about what we define as energy. For example, like when you said free energy, and you spoke from a financial or an economic point of view, one of the things I run into a lot is the term spirit energy. And unfortunately, those terms are also mutually exclusive because energy is a physical thing. But let me cast it into another light.
Okay.
What I'm saying is this, is that the pockets of space-time, which are bent from outside of space-time, create the environment in which physical matter forms.
All right, we have to pick up there when we come back from this break. It is taking over. It's going to boot us off of the mic. All right, we'll be back right after this, folks. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show and my guest this evening, Tom Fusco. We're on Final Approach here, and man, this stuff's so deep. What a mind bender. I love this. Tom, as we went away, you were about to talk to us about these, I think you said pockets of energy caused by, or pockets of gravity caused by the warping of time-space.
Yes. According to my model, as I had mentioned, it is not material that bends space and causes gravity, but it is the curvatures of space in which material actually arises and comes into being. So what we have is a model now where we have these pockets of space-time that have an inward-focused flow. And in the center of that flow, the density of it, it becomes so great that it materializes into matter and energy. What this means, then, that gravity is not the attractive force that they taught us, but it's actually almost like a repulsive force that pushes down onto objects, that when smaller objects are caught into its current, that are actually carried down to and held down onto the surfaces of planets rather than being like a magnet. If that's the case, then where that concentration, that inward flow and focus of those bent fields in space are so concentrated that you're going to get that kind of twisting that I was explaining earlier in haunted houses that produces electromagnetic fields. So from that respect, we can tap into virtually, from a human point of view, a limited amount of an unlimited amount, an infinite supply of electromagnetism by the very forces that assemble the Earth into a sphere.
Well, that has huge implications for space travel as well, doesn't it?
Absolutely. But there's even a greater a feat that we could create with this. If we could learn how to intentionally bend space, if we have a spacecraft, and I'm going to go to UFOs, I'm going to go there, Kevin.
That's okay.
Let's say if we have a UFO, mm-hmm. and it's an intelligently designed craft, and from every indication by their behavior, it appears that they have cracked the code of the mechanics behind phenomenon haunted houses and have actually built technology on them because they behave in the same way as paranormal phenomena does. If we're able to bend the space in front of our spacecraft and create a pocket, our ship will begin to fall into it, like over the ledge of a cliff. And then if we advance that pocket forward, instead of falling completely down in it, the craft will be pushed up against the edge of that pocket and pushed along like a surfer rides a wave. So we could have incredible velocities with no visible means of propulsion. Infinite energy, in a sense.
Do you think, and we've just got a few minutes left here, but do you think that in the so-called black world, the black ops, the black projects, that the scientists working there, which quite obviously we know, even though we don't know exactly what they're working on, we do know that they are years and years and years ahead of the state of technology that we're aware of. Do you think it's possible that some of these guys have begun to master that and that it's possible they may actually have at least some rudimentary craft able to do that?
I believe it's quite possible. And I would say, Kevin, from a personal point of view, I really do pray that they never let any of us know until it comes time when we're in trouble and we need to kick some butt and wait to see what we pull out of our hangars. I don't want to know.
Well, I think you're going to get your wish. Yeah, I think that's exactly how it will be. They're not going to let us know. But, go ahead.
Kevin, when we went over to Iraq the first time in Kuwait,
yeah,
and pulled out these super weapons, these laser-guided weapons, the whole world fainted in the same way as they did when they heard about the Battle of the Monitor and the Merrimack. They just realized that their entire arsenals were obsolete.
And General Schwarzkopf said in a press conference from Iraq that if Saddam Hussein does not surrender, we have things to throw at him he cannot begin to imagine. When the press questioned him about what he meant, he said, all of this technology that you're seeing now, these weapons that you're seeing now, and you're just awestruck by them, those are obsolete. We've got things he can't begin to imagine.
I sure do hope so, Kevin. I hope we got our own fleet of UFOs just waiting to kick butt if we need them.
Well, there are people out there, Tom, who say that we do, in fact, that they have very non-conventional propulsion systems, and what you're talking about would be non-conventional. You're talking about basically creating a gravitational bubble around the spacecraft, right?
Yes. Actually, around the spacecraft and in front of the spacecraft.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you also have the bubble around the spacecraft, then you have a static bubble of relative space that you could take a ship going 3,000 miles an hour and make a 90-degree turn, and the occupants would just think that they were just sitting in their living room.
And your model of the universe explains how that is possible.
Absolutely.
Where can people get your book, Tom?
You can find all the information about the book and where to order it by going to www.cosmicveil, spelled V-E-I-L, cosmicveil.com, and it's all there.
All right, and let me say folks, if you're at my website, you can click on Tom's picture, and it will take you to that site. There's also there a free chapter for you to read. And I think I read it. It's quite engaging. And, you know, if you're interested in the paranormal, if you're interested in UFOs, if you're interested in free energy, or if you just like new concepts, this book really is very, very, very interesting. And I encourage you to get your hands on it and read it. Tom, what's next for you?
What's next for me is to get the message out, Kevin, is to begin to engage the paranormal community, as I've been trying to do through the talk shows, and the ufology community, and help them and say, look, this cosmological framework that you've been searching for all these decades, to plug all of these factoids in, here it is. This will make everything make sense to you. And everything will start to coalesce. And that's my mission right now.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for being with us. And if you will, just stay on the line with me for a moment. And I'd like to chat with you for just a moment after we go off the air. Ladies and gentlemen, that's it. That's a wrap for this evening. Tom Fosco, and click his picture at my website. Go over and read that first chapter of the book. I think after you do, you're going to want to get your hands on it. You can tell from our interview that it is deep and it is interesting. So especially those of you who like to think you are thinkers, I like to think I'm a thinker. And, well, you're going to really like the thinking you'll do with this book. Again, the title of the book is Behind the Cosmic Veil, A New Vision of Reality. My friends call me Steele Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you'd like to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.